Coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening.
Good morning and welcome to this two-hour Main Street Radio special from Duluth. I'm Rachel Reby. We're talking today about mining, one of Minnesota's major industries for the past 100 years. Government and industry officials are gathering here at the Duluth Convention Center for a three-day conference on the future of mining in Minnesota. At noon, we'll talk about the challenges facing the taconite industry, as well as the opportunities for mining copper, nickel, and platinum up in this corner of the state. But before we look to the future, let's look back. The discovery of rich deposits of iron ore changed the landscape of northeastern Minnesota and shaped its settlement and culture. Our guests this morning are Iron Range historian Marva Lampa, Ed Nelson, archivist at the Iron Range Research Center, and Mike Hillman, a fourth-generation miner from Ely. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning, Rachel.
Listeners, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. If you're in the Twin Cities, you can call us today at 651-227-6000. If you're outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828. The first miners in northeastern Minnesota weren't looking for iron ore. Apparently, they were after gold. Marvin Lampa, tell us about Minnesota's gold rush.
Well, at the end of the Civil War, the whole temperament of our country was turned toward such things as gold discoveries. Gold had been discovered in Idaho, California, in fact, in many places in the country. And then when the Minnesota State geologist, Henry Eames, came back from an exploration trip in northeast Minnesota with word that there was gold-bearing quartz at Lake Vermilion, the whole state went wild and the rush was on.
And people, did they flood here just like they did the California Gold Rush? Did they head up to northeastern Minnesota?
That's correct. Before the Gold Rush, Americans didn't know what existed north of Lake Superior. There had been rumors of riches. There had been talk of copper and other metals throughout the area. And in 1849, the first real survey of the area took place in what was called the Owens Survey of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa territories. At that time, explorer James Norwood went up the St. Louis River out of Duluth, the Duluth area, and went to Lake Vermilion. On the Vermilion River, he noted gold-bearing quartz. When the report came out, the entire legislature of the new state of Minnesota, which had just formed in 1858, there was nothing but talk of gold among them. The governor of the state was interested in gold, and therefore he hired one Henry H. Eames as state geologist at a salary of $2,000 to go up to Lake Vermilion and northeast Minnesota and verify those claims.
And this was up in your corner of the world, Mike.
Yep. Pretty close to home, Rachel.
So there on Lake Vermilion is where they supposedly came up with gold, reportedly.
That's correct. And to this day, nobody knows where the Eames samples came from. But when they came back, they were assayed at bearing gold at the rate of $40 per ton. Experts in gold mining told everybody that, remember, in California, gold is being mined at $10 a ton, and in Minnesota, it's $40 a ton. Soon, newspaper headlines were out in Detroit, Chicago, New York, and literally thousands of people rushed to northeast Minnesota to stake out claims on Lake Vermilion to find gold. But not one of them struck it rich. In fact, a gold town appeared called Winston City, a regular gold town like the Old West, saloons, gambling halls, the whole thing. It lasted for 3 years. At the end of 3 years, the rush was over, and the whole northeast Minnesota was once again abandoned and would be for a number of years. But the thing about the gold rush was that people who knew something about mining came back and said, there's a huge mountain of iron up there. And at that time, the United States was expanding with railroads and things of this sort and looking for new sources of iron. And that huge mountain of iron caught the imagination of developers and steel mills all over the country, and explorers came up to look for iron ore.
So the gold rush, it was in part responsible for the iron ore rush.
That is correct, for calling attention to that huge, huge mountain of iron. Nothing like that had ever existed. But you got to remember, at this time, they were talking specifically about the Vermilion Range. The Mesabi Range was untouched. Nobody knew about the soft, crumbly ore that was lying just underneath the ground.
They walked over 99% of the iron to get to less than 2%, would you say, Marvin?
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys that went up in that gold rush, 1852 was when George Riley Stuntz, the government surveyor, came to this country. And according to what I've read in your studies, North Albert Posey, part of the Treaty of La Pointe, one of the deals that they made with the Indian people who call Lake Vermilion their home was, look, we want to make you useful citizens, and so we're going to teach you blacksmithing.
That's correct.
And apparently some of the class went out on an extracurricular project, and they found some of this beautiful blue iron. And North Albert Posey recognized what they had brought in. He went down to Stuntz, and Stuntz told him, relax. This iron came from Michigan.
That's correct. Stuntz thought it did.
I've seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
They traded for it. And he was wrong. He'd discover his error three years later.
He came back to the Lewis and says, boys, when that mountain of iron is going to be developed, they'll bring in supplies and they'll bring them in cheap.
See, he never had his obituary. It's so sad when you read about him that you read his obituary and it says, George Riley Stuntz helped make the fortune of many men. Sad to say, the same cannot be said for himself. He found this iron, but he didn't have the money to develop it. He got in touch with George Stone, a lawyer down in Duluth. America in 1866, the demand for steel, for iron, wasn't there. They could satisfy that demand in Michigan, and nobody really wanted to speculate. So 9 years go by, 1875, the demand starts to rise in America. And people out east say, what was that lawyer's name in Duluth, the Stone? Yeah, let's get in touch with him and maybe take a look at this. And that's when the first test blast, really?
Yeah, you got to remember, in 1873, Duluth was booming. A man by the name of Jay Cook had a tremendous scheme of bringing a railroad across the country. And Duluth was going to be the major inland port for the United States. Well, in 1873, the Jay Cook house fell, and Duluth became a ghost town. Now, tied up in all of this was George Stone, the lawyer that is being talked about here. And Stone lost everything at the same time. He was anxious to get his fortune back.
So there were a lot of fortunes made and lost during this period in this part of the country.
That's correct.
Let's talk about what northeastern Minnesota looked like. You're talking about Duluth was big and booming before it became a ghost town. But Ed, what the rest of northeastern Minnesota look like? Was it settled? Was it wild? What did it look like?
Well, as Marvin said, they hadn't even done the survey, so there really weren't a lot of reports. Northeastern Minnesota, the area that ended up being the Iron Range, is on the top of a three-way watershed. Waters flow north, they flow east, and they flow south. So it had been an area where the native peoples had kind of a transportation hub. So there had been people visiting the area, going through it. But I guess the imagination would be that it was pretty wild country. And if you got off the rivers, you were in the swamps and the muskeg, and very difficult to get the infrastructure in that was necessary for the mining.
Because there was no way to get around. No roads, no tracks, no trains.
Right. And when you look at, you were talking earlier about the gold rush and the impact that had, well, it brought a road in to the Vermilion Lake country. And it also, all this activity going on in St. Paul and the newspapers, there were mining companies forming every day, and people from Chicago and New York and Milwaukee were investing, buying stocks in these gold mining companies, thinking they were going to get rich. So it was the first attempt to accumulate capital that some of these mining companies needed to haul this equipment in to set up these gold mining operations. when the market fell out and the people left, that effort at beginning mining failed. But what a lot of people probably made a lot of money collecting this capital in these stocks that turned out probably to be worthless, and maybe these mining companies never actually went to the Vermilion Range.
Our phone lines are open. Our phone number here is 1-800-242-2828. If you are outside the metropolitan area, 1-800-242-2828. And if you are inside the metropolitan area, call us at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you have any questions about the early days of iron mining 100 years ago in northeastern Minnesota, give us a call and ask the experts. Or if you have your own story to share, your grandparents came over on the boat, give us a call and share your story. 1-800-242-2828. So we've jumped ahead now, 1890, no roads, lots of trees in northeastern Minnesota. One account I read said that there was probably no landscape in the country that was as altered so quickly or so completely as the landscape of northeastern Minnesota.
That is correct. I think it's one of the most changed places, certainly in the state of Minnesota. In the beginning, it was a vast white pine forest, as virgin as you could imagine. The entire Mesabi was this way. And it didn't look like mining country at all. The only clue was that in the railroad that had been run to the Tower Mines on the Vermilion Range into Ely had to cut through the ridge called, which we call the Mesabi. At one point, iron ore stood right out of the ground so that everybody passing by in the train could look out the window and see iron ore.
And did they know what they were looking at? Did they know that was money? There was money in their hills?
You are talking about the kind of people who knew exactly what that was. These are the kind of people that were coming to Ely and Tower. They knew the mining business, they knew what minerals were, and they could see the iron ore.
And some of them came from Michigan, Mike. Those were your people, weren't they?
When Charlemagne Tower started the mine, the original mine was under the direction of Jack Armstrong, and there were 50 essentially what I would call wildcat miners. The iron stood above the greenstone around it. It was very easy. It was hard work, but it was easy to mine. The difference between the Mesabi and the Vermilion Range, all of a sudden these guys start to chase that iron as it went down, and they found out at Sedan Hill it goes down at a 78-degree angle. And they didn't have the expertise to handle it. And Charlemagne Tower, it's a charming letter that he wrote to George Stone about, you told me that anybody could come here and mine this. I spend millions of dollars for a railroad and to get this mine started, and then you tell me I'm going to have to go and get professional miners? And where am I going to find them? And connections with Michigan Mining, Brighting. Ed Brighting was a friend of Tower, and Tower, he says, Charlemagne, if you want to get a good captain, go up to Michigan at the Vulcan mine and talk to Elisha Morecambe. He was one of the Cornish men that came to Michigan to do iron mining. And they signed him up. Morecambe signed up 150 miners and their families. My great-grandparents were part of that contingent, and they loaded him on a railroad train. And I don't know what my great-grandfather said to his wife when he came home. Honey, guess what? I got a new job. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Yeah, a promotion. I'm going to Minnesota. And from what I've heard, Superior, Wisconsin was the end of the civilized world. Duluth was a wild and woolly place. They walked 3 days and two nights from Duluth on the Vermilion Trail to get to Sedan Hill, and that was on March 17th. 1884, and it was. They're still fighting in Tower Sedan over whether it was the 30th of July or the 31st of July of 1884. And I don't want to offend anybody in Tower Sedan. So
it was late July.
Yes, and they loaded 20 wooden ore cars, and everybody in town, including the Lake Vermilion Indian people, came and they danced for the occasion. And everybody in Tower Sedan threw a piece of iron on the train, and they put a pine tree in the last ore car as it went out of town, and that really began the the active phase of Minnesota iron mining.
That's right. While all this was going on, men were getting off the station, getting off the railroad at Mesaba Station, which was on the south side of the Mesaba Ridge, where that iron on the Mesaba stuck out of the ground, and began going out in the woods searching for iron. Think about this iron on the Mesaba was, compasses went wild from magnetic attraction, yet they went wild near what seemed like lean ore exposures, which made sense. But sometimes, even miles away from the exposures, the compasses went wild again. It got to thinking there got to be ore down there, but nobody could figure out what the ore was, because the old idea of iron ore was that it was hard and dense, and you needed special miners to get it up, just like on the Vermilion Range.
And, Mr. Nelson, it was nothing like that on the Mesaba.
No, the Mesaba is a different type of ore formation, soft and powdery. And what did the Merritts say? That it was more like farming than it was iron mining.
Well, when the Merritts finally found their mine at the Mountain Iron Mine, they founded it, they were determined to show the world what they discovered what the Mesaba ore was. It was the soft, powdery ore that was only a few feet below the surface. On the Vermilion Range, underground mines were going down hundreds of feet, even approaching 1,000 feet under the ground. But on the Mesaba, the ore lay flat under the ground a few feet underneath. So the Merritts took plows and horses and exposed the ore body and then called in experts from Michigan. They all came on, took one look at the Merritt mine, and they said, the Merritts aren't miners, they're farmers.
So that's when the trees came down.
That's right.
Because to mine that kind of ore, they needed everything gone.
That's correct.
So that turned the trees into stumps.
Because the Mesaba became, for its vast beds of ore below the ground, open pit mine. Any fool could mine on the Mesaba Range. It didn't take any expertise. You pick and a shovel, and you could mine. In fact, in the early days of the rush, and there was a terrible rush for iron on the Mesaba Range, just like the gold rush, maybe even wilder, because people thought, geez, all you need is a rope and a well bucket, and you're in the mining business. A wheelbarrow could do it. But it turned out that the only way the Mesaba could be done profitably was through mechanized means like steam shovels. And then it was the big mining companies that could do that, not the small man. And even though it was hailed as the poor man's iron range, the Mesaba was really opened up by very organized, financially strong mining companies.
Harnessing unskilled labor from other countries, though. Isn't that right, Mike?
According to what I've read, over 41 different nationalities came to work on the Vermilion Range. I don't know if that...
All of that on the Mesaba. Maybe
probably more.
Some, yeah.
And what were the primary nationalities that came? And how did they, on the other side of the world, how did they even find out about it?
That's always been a question that historians have debated. There's a school of thought that there was actual recruiting going on in Europe. But it seems that the vast number of them came to this range because of letters written home. Now, the first influx of foreign miners to the Midwest came into Michigan. In fact, my grandfather came out of the northern Norway through those things to become a miner in Michigan at Hancock, Michigan. And there... They came in and wrote home, talked about this wonderful America. The streets are paved in gold in America, things of this sort. Well, Europe being like it is, it was a place to go. Every young man wanted to come to the United States. And when the Mesaba opened up, there was a job for everyone. You could be a farmer's son with no skills in mining whatsoever and get a job on the Mesaba Range. And the pay was good by European standards.
And if you look at the time period in history when this happened, in the 1870s and 1880s, people were coming across the ocean in steamship or in sailing ships, and it was a difficult and dangerous journey. But by the late 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, the transportation had improved so much, and the cost for coming to America had gone down so much. It also coincided with many of these countries in Europe where your population was growing, there weren't jobs for the young people, And you got a letter from your uncle or cousin in the United States in the Mesaba Range, come over here. You can make two, three, four times what you can make back in the old country. Get rich, go back home and buy that farm you always dreamed of. And a lot of them had big dreams in their eyes. Come over, make their stake, and head back home. And a lot of the early people did. But there was a real pull. You go where the money is, and that's why they were coming.
And did your Norwegian relatives, were they planning that this would be a temporary stay?
No, my grandfather was the sixth son on a small Norwegian farm. And I asked him when he was an old man, what brought you here? And he still spoke with that wonderful Norwegian brogue. And he says, my future in Norway was to live in the barn on my older brother's charity, or to come to America and work for 22 cents an hour in the iron mines. And I said, what was that really to you? He says, oh, God, Mike, he says, that was more money than I ever thought I'd see in my life. He says, was so much money a man couldn't even drink it up. He says, I know, I give her a good go a couple of times.
So there wasn't much of a choice for some of these people. It was stay home and starve, or come across the ocean and have a whole new life.
The 100 years ago in Ely, the 1890s, you had that big panic and that depression. And a lot of the mines in Ely and across the Mesabi Range shut down. In Ely, there was only one iron mine operating, and that was the Chandler. The late 1890s, things start to recover. 100 years ago, the old settlers in Ely, who started out in the 1888 era, they were complaining because so many foreigners were coming to town. This is true. 100 years later, mm-hmm. we're still complaining about the same thing.
Yes.
History does repeat itself, but they were the Slovenian influx, the main Yugoslavian influx to Ely, was just starting. And according to what they say in Ely, Father Joseph Boo wrote so many letters back to the priest that he went to the seminary with, that when the word got out, that's why there's so many Slovenian people that settled in Ely.
So a lot of word of mouth to get the people over.
A lot of word of mouth, and the fact that you could get a steamship ticket pretty cheaply to come to the United States. You could also get a train right out to Duluth. Most of the people were checked in from Europe right here in Duluth, right here on the shore of this lake. And then they went up by train to the range. There was a job. All you needed to do was to look strong. You had a job in the mine. That's
what ages? We talking about young men?
We're talking about young men, 16 to 20, 16 to 21. Young men, just fresh out of the old country. The dirt of the old country still on their boots as they went into the mines of the iron country.
So let's talk about the major nationalities. What were the big pockets of nationalities that came here? What were the big ones?
Well, there were Finns, there were Swedes, there were Norwegians, there were Croatians, there were Montenegrins, there were Serbians, there were Italians, there were Belgium, there were Arabs, and even Chinese who came to live here on the range. A tremendous number of people.
Kongwe's Laundry in Ely.
That's right.
And they all came here looking for money.
Oh, of course, it was a place to go. It was a booming place. Whenever a new mining development occurs, whether it was the Old West or the Mesaba Range, this was the place you make your fortune.
Did most of them go back, or did most of them stay?
Well, that's a question. Some did go back. Even a fair large number left the area, but were replaced by new people. But it wasn't so easy to go back to the old country. Suddenly, the trains which ran into the mines of Iron Country didn't run out quite the same way. People soon had contacts. They didn't save up the money that they had planned to save. And besides that, when World War I broke out, if you were Slovenian, if you were Croatian, if you were Montenegrin or Italian, you didn't go back to the old country. Because if you did, you were drafted into the army to fight on the side of the Central Powers against the United States of America.
One more reason to stay here. We have Dan on the phone. Good morning, Dan. Welcome to Main Street.
Hi. Great show. Thank you for taking my call. And I missed the first part of the show. You may have touched on this, but I'm curious about what was driving this need suddenly for iron ore, and also say a little bit about the original transportation for getting it out of this country, if they did do that.
What was driving the need for iron ore?
Well, two things happened. One was that all those old colonial bridges out east that were made of wood with the wooden roofs on them began falling into disrepair. The second was, in the Civil War, railroad building needed steel for rails. Now, the thing about this was a process had been invented, in fact, in 1856, by Henry Bessemer in England to make cheap steel. Now, steel was the most wonderful iron product you could find. It didn't wear out. It was powerful. It was strong. It was almost like a miracle. And it was made very cheaply under the Bessemer process. But the problem was that in the United States, most of the mines that existed in Pennsylvania couldn't be used in the Bessemer process because they had too much phosphorus in them. But the mines of the Lake Superior District had low phosphorus, and that's what drove the people to this area. Actual need by our steel industry to expand and to meet the needs of the country.
You're listening to a special Main Street Radio broadcast from the Duluth Convention Center. I'm Rachel Reby. My guests are Mike Hillman, a fourth-generation miner from Ely, Iron Range historian Marvin Lampa, and Ed Nelson, archivist at the Iron Range Research Center. We'll be back with more of Main Street after a look at news and weather.
Coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant-making, leadership training, and convening.
Congress is about to decide whether to fund a massive expansion of the locks and dam system on the Mississippi River. The debate has fueled the division between the river's navigation interests and environmentalists. Whose river is it? What's at stake in the debate? See Changing Course, the Future of the Mississippi River. It's on NPR's website at minnesotapublicradio.org.
It's 27 minutes before 12 noon with news from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Stephen John. Sailors have stabilized the USS Cole following last week's apparent suicide bombing at a port in Yemen. Meantime, officials are trying to find out who's behind the attack that left 17 American soldiers dead. Israelis and Palestinians continue to fight as their leaders talk. Palestinians took part in violent demonstrations across the West Bank and Gaza today. A White House spokesman describes the early hours of an emergency Mideast summit in Egypt as businesslike and serious. A big step forward by the pro-democracy forces in Yugoslavia as they try to sweep allies of Slobodan Milosevic from positions of power. The Milosevic backers have signed an agreement to share power with the followers of the new president in Serbia, Yugoslavia's main republic. One of the nation's foremost film and theater critics is dead. Vincent Canby was 76. He died of cancer yesterday. Canby delivered sober judgments along with wry humor in his reviews in the New York Times for more than 35 years. A man whose name became synonymous with the communist movement in the United States, Minnesota native Gus Hall, has died. The American Communist Party says its leader died Friday at a New York hospital. He was 90 years old. Hall was born in Virginia, Minnesota. He's stuck to his beliefs through years in prison and even after the collapse of communist regimes around the world. The College of St. Scholastica in Duluth is expanding its evening college to St. Paul this fall. St. Scholastica officials say they are confident Scholastica will find its place in the Twin Cities' competitive adult education market. Within the next few years, Scholastica hopes to have 300 students attending classes at its satellite campus in the basement of the historic St. Paul Club. The forecast calling for partly sunny conditions, mainly across the whole state today. Maybe more clouds in the south. Highs from the low 50s north to low 60s in the south. There's a chance of some showers this evening. In the Twin Cities now it's 45 degrees. Duluth has 43. In Rochester, 46 and 42 in St. Cloud. That's news from Minnesota Public Radio.
Welcome back to Duluth and our Main Street special. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're broadcasting from the Convention Center on Duluth's waterfront. Registration is underway here for a major minerals development conference. Industry experts and government officials are coming together for 3 days to focus on the future of mining in Minnesota. We'll discuss the prognosis for iron ore and the potential for copper, nickel, and platinum mines in Minnesota at noon. But first, we're looking at how iron mining shaped the face of Minnesota's Iron Range. My guests are Ed Nelson, archivist at the Iron Range Research Center, Iron Range historian Marvin Lampa and Mike Hillman, a fourth-generation miner from Ely. Listeners, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. Were your grandparents part of the immigration wave that settled the Iron Range? Call us and share your memories. If you're in the Twin Cities, you can call at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're outside the metro area, call us at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. We go to the phones now. We have Dorothy from Burnsville on the line. Good morning, Dorothy. Welcome to Main Street.
Hi, I have two questions. One is, help me with the geography a little bit. What cities are in the Vermilion Range, what in the Mesabi Range? And the second one is, when I was in school, I can remember hearing about the third range, the Cuyuna Range. Can you tell me about that, too?
Good questions. Let's clear that up for you.
Cuyuna Range was named after Kyler Adams and his dog, Una. He took the first part of his name, Kyler, and combined it with what may have been his best friend at the time, Una, who was a St. Bernard, and that's how it got named Cuyuna. The Vermilion Range, Marvin, you can handle the Mesabi because that's lots more to handle.
Okay.
The Vermilion Range is really easy. It's Tower, Sedan, Ely, and Section 30, just a little settlement about a mile and a half as the crow flies from Ely. And that was it for the Vermilion Range mining. Mud Creek never quite developed. It was a might have been, and then when they discovered so much ore where Marvin and Ed are from, they didn't have to invest the money in the Vermilion Range anymore.
So the Vermilion Range was the farthest most north.
Yes.
Then we come slightly southwest to the Mesabi Range.
Slightly southwest, and the range runs something like 90 miles, beginning in town of Babbitt, where I live, all the way to the Grand Rapids and the Mississippi River. It was, and on it are such towns as Hoyt Lakes, Aurora, Bywabic, Gilbert, Eveleth, Virginia, Mountain Iron, Buell, Nashua, Keewatin, Hibbing, Bovee, Coleraine. Did I miss any?
You missed Taconite and Marble.
Taconite and Marble.
So those are the towns of the Mesabi Range.
That's
and
right.
The Cuyuna Range, again, coming farther southwest.
And on the Cuyuna Range, the main towns are Ironton and Crosby. Crosby and Ironton, which are close together. The Cuyuna Range was unique in the fact that it had already been developed as farming country after the lumber industry had gone by. There was no sign whatsoever on the surface that there would be iron ore below the ground, although it had been suspected. In fact, one of the first people to try to find iron ore was a Finn by the name of Henry Pyary, who came out of Michigan, who got off the train at Deerwood Station, went out in the woods and picked up some rocks and said, "Gee, that just looks like Michigan ore." He went back to Michigan. He was going to buy a farm out in at the western part of the United States. But at that moment, he changed his mind, went back to Michigan, got a test pit crew, came back, and began test pitting the area. But when his test pits filled with water and no iron ore was found, he gave up. And he never did become the first discoverer of ore. The person who discovered ore later on was the famous Kyler Adams, whose dog was Cuyuna, from which the range gets its name.
And that's a famous gravesite I have visited. That dog is buried in Crosby mm-hmm. with a little headstone.
That's correct. The thing about the Cuyuna ore...
I should be so lucky, eh?
The thing about the Cuyuna ore was that they had a large amount of manganese in them.
So slightly different configuration than
that's
was
correct.
Found farther to the north.
Yeah.
Let's continue with our phone calls. John from Minneapolis is holding on the line. Good morning, John. Welcome to Main Street.
No, thank you for taking my call. I wonder if your guests would tell the story of how the Merritt brothers, who were prominent in the very beginning, ended up really not being in the business hardly at all, that they were kind of outplayed and outmaneuvered along the years. And I just wonder if they'd relate the story of how all that came about. Thank you. I'll take
Thanks,
my answer
John.
Off the air.
Marvin, I know this is one of your favorites, isn't it?
Well, Ed can help me out on this, too. The thing is that the Merritt family was a Duluth family. They were local people who had come to Duluth in the late 1850s to exploit the lumber industry in the newly opened country north of Duluth, which had been opened by Treaty of the Point in 1854. It was the father Merritt who got involved in the gold rush, but when he came back to Duluth, he came back with a chunk of iron in his hand, and he had an undying faith that somewhere north, and he believed it was the Mesabi Range, that would have the iron ore that would really make people wealthy. And he passed it on to his seven sons, and it was the seven sons of Lewis Merritt who came up to northeast Minnesota in the 1880s and began a search for this ore. Remember, we had talked about the fact that the ore, people thought there must be ore under the ground, but nobody could find it because they were looking for this hard, dense substance. Well, it was the Merritt family who put in test pits in the area of what today is Mountain Iron. And about 60 feet down, they hit this blue substance. They had it assayed. It assayed 60% iron. It was the very ore that everyone had been looking for. And it was, in fact, Leonidas Merritt, one of the brothers, who said if he had just kicked that red dust and kicked it hard enough, we would have kicked up 60% iron, the very ore that everyone was looking for. It was only then that people realized that Mesabi ore was entirely different from any ore ever discovered, and there was more of it than anyone had dreamed.
So it started out very promising for the Merritt brothers.
That's
they
right.
knew it was there. They were willing to go look for it. How were they outmaneuvered? Ed, tell us about it.
It has to do with the time period that it was developed, and in 1890 things looked pretty good. It cost them a lot of money to put in the infrastructure, to build the railroad, to build the ore docks, to get ready to mine. And in 1892, late in the fall, the first ore was shipped. Well, that had an adverse effect on the Merritt's hopes and dreams and plans. When they calculated their costs and their rate of return that they needed to get on this ore, it came out to a certain tonnage. Well, when price per ton, then when the ore came on market, the price for ore dropped, in partly in anticipation of all this Mesaba ore coming on. So in 1893, the fact that the ore prices were dropping and there was a national depression put them in severe financial straits. They had stretched themselves to the limit. They had creditors in Duluth that were crying for, you know, make payroll, you have this stuff. So they were in deep trouble.
So they had to turn someplace else for resources.
Mm-hmm. And they turned to the one man who could help them, John D. Rockefeller. And it was John D. Rockefeller who they got associated with to form a company to keep their mines afloat. Well, some loans were passed out to them, and in the end, the Merritts gradually took their mines up as collateral for loans that they had to take out to keep the ore going. And those loans came from John Rockefeller. In the end, John Rockefeller held 51% of the stock in the mines and railroad shipping the ore, and the Merritts were out. And thus, this Duluth family, who could have possibly made Duluth a completely different kind of place than it is today, lost all their holdings in northeast Minnesota.
So another fortune almost won.
Almost made.
But if you look at, Rachel, if you look at the history of the mining industry, and, you know, those of us that live up on the Iron Range, sometimes we think that it's the center of the world, but actually in the big scheme of things, it's like, if you look at it like a dog, it's like the tail of the dog. All the decisions that were made about what happened in the mines in northeastern Minnesota were made someplace else. If Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Chicago or Gary needed a certain type of ore and it was available from this mine, that mine kept going. If they didn't need it, they could shut that mine down. So having the whole integrated system from the mines to the steel mills shaped the history of northeastern Minnesota. The Merritts were only one of several mining companies that were trying to get going in this time period, and there were lots of different mining companies. But by the time U.S. Steel formed in 1902, it was down to 13 mining companies that had pretty much control over everything, and four of those had just one mine. So the consolidation, the investment of capital in this area came very, very quickly to build this industry, and the actual control ended up in the hands of a few people with lots of capital to make it happen.
Rockefeller's move for power here, which is what it was, alarmed Andrew Carnegie enough that Carnegie sent Oliver.
Henry Oliver.
To buy mines, because he was worried that Rockefeller would control the iron, he would control the shipping, he would control the railroad, and what was going to stop Rockefeller from putting the same kind of stranglehold that he did on the Merritts to Carnegie. And Carnegie went and said, Henry Oliver, come to northern Minnesota. I want you to buy me some mines. And he did.
These were, how shall we say, rough and tumble years. Either you made it or you lost. And that's the game that Carnegie played, that the game Rockefeller played. And today, yes, often we describe them as such because that's how they appear. But the two, at one time, there were three interests controlling all of the ore coming out of the whole area. One was the Porter interest out of Chicago. The other was John Rockefeller, who held the old Merritt mines at Bawabic and Mountain Iron. And the other was Andrew Carnegie, whose man Henry Oliver was picking up the mining. Well, the three came together with an agreement, and out of that agreement emerged that the United States Steel Corporation, which now held the mines, the mills, and the transportation of the ore to the mills. The entire thing.
Let's go to the phones. Luann is patiently waiting in Minneapolis. Good morning, Luann. Welcome to Main Street.
Hi there. My question is, do you know if there were any Native Americans inhabiting the Mesabi Range area during this time period?
What about the Native peoples,
the people of northeast Minnesota, what we call and what we sometimes call the Iron Range Indian people, were the Boys Fort Ojibwe Indians. They were former trappers for the Hudson's Bay Company and the British. Now, it's an interesting thing. When the state of Minnesota was formed in 1858, the people living on the Iron Range, the Indian people living on the Iron Range, did not consider themselves American citizens. They were British subjects. They traded almost entirely with the British to the north. And it was only after the discovery of gold and the establishment of an Indian agency on Lake Vermilion that these Indian people were gradually brought into the sphere of the United States of America. But their ancestors of the Ojibwe people living today were all British subjects.
We go to Lee, who is standing by in Iron. Good morning, Lee. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your question, your comment.
Morning, Ed. Hi, Marv. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the history of mining locations, specifically Fraser location that was near Chisholm. And as I recall, it might have been known as the smallest city in the world at one time. If either of you have some expertise about Fraser, could you, tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Fraser was an incorporated village that was incorporated by the area mining company. And there were a number of these company villages that were incorporated.
Because they had to have some place to live. They were coming here with nothing.
It was just a little more than that. It was the fact that in 1909, the Minnesota legislature passed a law that would allow the incorporated villages of the range to expand their boundaries to include mining properties, thus passing the ad valorem tax and getting hold of it for the development of the village. This alarmed the companies because they would, of course, be stuck with a great tax burden of the area. So what they did in response was to incorporate their mining properties into villages. Fraser was the result of one of these, and so was Cooley, and so was Fail, and Franklin. All came about due to these things. And the location, the Fraser village, but you got to remember they were in a sea of hundreds of locations that had been unincorporated. But as the mines expanded, the corporations or the locations were dismantled, and people moved elsewhere. Today there are no locations really in existence on the range anymore. But at one time, There were 175 little towns across the Mesabi and Vermilion Range. And that's Dr. Arnold Allenin's count, who has done a special study on locations.
So you lived there, you worked there, your kids went to school there once they got the schools?
It was home. It was the place they lived. Today, those places live only in memory.
Well, in these days of ethnic cleansing and cultural clashes, it is very hard to picture Arabs, Chinese, Norwegians, Finns, Serbs living together in one spot. Was it one mine, one culture? Were the Finns work in this mine and then the Serbs were over in that mine, or was it just a free-for-all?
You need to put it in context of this being a rural area, but very industrially controlled. The towns, if you look at the city officials and the school boards and the people that had control of the political system, they were old Americans, pretty much worked with the mining companies, with the industry. It was in their best interest to have homes, stable communities, these locations.
Because they wanted to keep the people?
They wanted to keep the people there. And by 1905, 1907, you saw a lot of young women coming to this country because you had all these young single miners that spent, you know, every Saturday night in the saloons, and they wanted a good, stable workforce. So this infrastructure came about, and the mining companies provided for their the families.
And did the women come on their own, or did the mining companies provide that just like they provided the housing?
I think probably it goes back again to the letters. You know, somebody's writing to their sister back in Finland saying, hey, you know, I got this guy, he's looking for a wife and you're looking for a new life, come on over. And
he doesn't speak, you know, English, he doesn't speak Finnish either, but come on over.
Right.
Was there quite a mixing of the cultures?
Yes, you see the mining companies with the locations, it was kind of first come, first serve. And it was in their interest to keep the ethnic groups mixed. And
so they didn't get too powerful, or just because it was easier that
way?
Just fill up the table before you set the next table, kind of.
Yes, and that was part of it. And you also have to remember, in the time of World War II, there was a lot of pro-American. If you wanted to work for the mining companies, you became a naturalized citizen. If you were a young child and you went to school, you didn't speak your native language. You had schools that were very well funded, they had the best of supplies, and everyone was encouraged to become an American. So within one generation, these children were indoctrinated. America, you were living here, this was the best country. You went to schools that looked like palaces, and there was a real melding of the ethnic groups.
Cool.
And the older generations probably spent more time arguing, but you know, when your child married an Italian, was probably worse for a Protestant to marry a Catholic. There's a real mixing that happened, I think, real early on.
One of the best pieces of advice that anybody ever gave me was Grandpa Vertin up in Ely, who had this wonderfully charming Slovenian accent. And he said to me one day, he says, Hillman, you go to school, learn to speak good American. He says, people listen to Grandpa talk, they think he's no smart because he speaks this way. That's why it's so important for you, go to school, learn to speak good American. Then they think you're a smart guy, even when you ain't.
Now that was kind. That was a compliment
good,
there someplace.
Good sound advice, though. They didn't want, my grandfather forbade the kids to answer in Norwegian because he wanted them to be Americans. He wanted them to speak well.
This happened a lot just around World War I. There was a tremendous Americanization. My mother taught Americanization classes in Eveleth, in which not only the kids went to school, but the parents.
We are halfway through this Main Street broadcast from the Duluth Convention Center. Our guests this morning, Ed Nelson, Marvin Lampa, and Mike Hillman. I'm Rachel Reeby. Next hour, we'll focus on the future of mining. There may be plenty of iron ore still in the ground, but how do you get it out and make a profit? Mines have been hard hit by foreign competition, increased production costs, and declining markets. We'll talk about ways to extend the life of this century-old industry. We're also going to explore the potential of copper, nickel, and platinum mining. We'll talk about it when this Main Street special continues.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 16th of October, 2000. It's the birthday of Günter Grass, born in Danzig, Germany, 1927. Won the Nobel Prize for Literature last year.
He was drafted into the German army when he was 16 years old in the last days of World War II, part of a young company sent off to the front, many members of which were ripped to shreds by American shells. Later supported himself as a black marketeer and a jazz drummer, speechwriter, and in the 50s as a sculptor and writer in Paris. His first play, his first poems were published in Paris. Came to international attention for his novel The Tin Drum in 1959, which made up a trilogy, the Danzig trilogy, along with his novels Cat and Mouse and Dog Years. It's the birthday of playwright Eugene O'Neill, born in New York City, 1888, in a hotel room. His mother took morphine during his birth and became a lifelong addict. His actor father and his mother served as models for James and Mary Tyrone in the play Long Day's Journey into Night. It's the birthday of Oscar Wilde, Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wilde. Born in Dublin, 1854, his mother a poet, his father an eye and ear surgeon. Graduated from Trinity College in Dublin, went off to London. His fame rests today on four comedies that he wrote in the 1890s, Lady Windermere's Fan, A Woman of No Importance, An Ideal Husband, and in 1895, The Importance of Being Earnest. His novel, also from the 1890s, The Picture of Dorian Gray, his collections of fairy tales, and The Ballad of Reading Jail, 1898, his account of prison conditions in England after he had served 2 years at hard labor, having been convicted of gross indecency. He was a homosexual, which was illegal in England at that time. He died after wandering Europe for 3.5 years under the name Sebastian Melmoth, died bankrupt, 46 years old, in a Paris hotel room in 1900, having been received in his final moments into the Roman Catholic Church. Oscar Wilde, who said, "A little sincerity is a dangerous thing, and a great deal of it is absolutely fatal." And it's the birthday of lexicographer Noah Webster, born in West Hartford, Connecticut, 1758, who did as much as anyone to form a sense of American English as our language, as separated from the English of the English. He came out with an American Dictionary of the English Language in 1828. Here's a poem for today by W.H. Auden. At last the secret is out. At last the secret is out, as it always must come in the end. The delicious story is ripe to tell to the intimate friend.